So yeah, our final week's lecture, modern art. We entered the 20th century twice already. We came in via Romanticism and then via the kind of Impressionism, Expressionism, Cubism. At that point, I called it the conceptual break, the point at which art stops being about what it's depicting and how it's depicting it and starts being about ideas and concepts. So this week, we're going to crush all of the vastness of 20th century art into one lecture, full of different isms that you might have to catch up with or go back and Google later if you're interested in them, because if you do a standard history of art course, we'd usually be here in about week two or three, and then we'd spend the whole rest of the time looking at the different paintings and modern art pieces. But I'm going to cover the overall trends, starting with kind of modernism and the start of the 20th century, and then looking towards the end of postmodernism at the end, and the kind of switch over into conceptual art that initially begins by having this liberatory idea that it's kind of art as a revolutionary force, whether that's whether that's spiritually revolutionary or whether it's politically revolutionary, and then switching over into this dynamic between whether art is a commodity or whether it's like anti-commodity, it's something that cannot be commodified. That's the tension in the second half. So in terms of our opening piece for the lecture, we've got a Rothko here, which I think Rothko is interesting because Rothko summarizes everything that people love and hate about modern art. When you see a real life Rothko blown up massive on the wall in an art gallery at the right setting when you're in the right mood to see it, he works in these little micro tones and grades of color so that you can go on and you can spend a lot of time with the image. But when you just kind of see it for the first time, you think, oh, it's just a big colored square. That's not real art, is it? So how do we get to a big red square from, you know, Picasso's Guernica, which I think is the last image that we saw in the lectures? Well, in terms of historical background, an important thing to note is the absolute massive culture shock that appears at the start of the 20th century. At the start of the 20th century, we have a whole bunch of things happening simultaneously that fully shake almost all of the confidence that had been existent in the past 100 years worth of progress, the idea of technological progress, of understanding the world. The Victorian world was one in which people were getting ever sort of richer, there was an ever increasing amount of technology, but none of those fundamental ideas about how the world worked were undermined. The science was based upon mechanistic science, kind of cause led to effect in a very simple, straightforward, easy to understand manner, and there was no complication between the us existing in the world and the world that's out there to be seen. Suddenly, at the turn of the 20th century, you have things like, in physics, the theory of relativity that suggests that there is no objective world, there is only kind of the world as it is seen from a certain perspective, that, you know, the world as I see it versus the world as someone on a train rushing past me sees it is fundamentally on a physical level a separate thing. And that happened at the same time as quantum physics, which suggests that right down on the smallest level, all existence is based on chance and on probability and not on solidity. There is no solid atoms at the core of things. There is just kind of forces of probability and fields of probability. At the same time, things like mass printing, radio, the development of telegrams and telegraphs meant that communication could be instant across the entire world. You could be live listening to something happening in Japan while you were eating your breakfast in London. And this shifted the way that people understood time, because you had to create the idea of, that idea of time zones comes out this time. Before that, you took, every single town had its own clock, and it would be someone's job to measure when the sun came up and when it set, and they would set the clock to the sun. In the start of the 20th century, everything got standardized, and there was a standardized time. And when people realized that you could standardize time, time became incredibly conceptual. And so existence itself, time, the speed at which things moved around was all rapidly shifting, and there was huge shifts in the way people lived. They became urban dwellers instead of rural dwellers, and we had this boom in growth and technology. In America, which is what we're seeing on the image here in New York, it was the birth of the American era. The American 20th century is an American, it's an American century, it's the American century. Americans were kind of, they're a people based upon getting rid of their past and living for themselves individually in the now, in the moment. And this new, exciting, thrilling instant kind of moment was the American moment. In Europe, it spells the end of the great empires, the end of this way of seeing the world that was defined in Britain by Queen Victoria in the period around then. And we see the emergence of the First World War as a kind of cataclysm driven in by these many contradictory forces. So we've got, I guess, the people still wanting to live like it's the Victorian era in the modern era leads to this war, which was, you know, idealized as being something glorious, which was full of machine guns and tanks and bombs and airplanes dropping bombs and mass death and, you know, chemical warfare, death on an unprecedented industrial scale. And that pretty much shook to its core Europe and all of its previous ideals. So what's happening in terms of art? Well, at the time of the First World War, we have Dada. And Dada is the anti-art movement. There's a lot of people who do art that's shocking, and that's kind of a way to make your art famous. But as far as I'm concerned, the first and only important kind of shocking like anti-art movement, transgressive art movement, was Dada. It came along during the build-up and then during the kind of 1914 to 1916 was its yearing, but really it was 1914 that it was the first 6 months of the war when it was massive. And it was a movement that thought art was part of this old way of seeing the world that was full of, you know, these ideas that no longer were relevant, and it was part of an aristocratic, kind of elite worldview, and it saw all of art being corrupted by this these old ways, and it wanted to tear art apart and destroy it. And so they did that on a very physical level by slicing up photographs and paintings and posters and sticking them back together to make them intentionally ugly, intentionally sort of grotesque and monstrous. Satires of politicians and thinkers, and this guy's getting a boot stamped on his head. And they would put on art shows that were kind of intentionally obnoxious and with loud music and sort of lots of drinking and booze and fighting and things like this. It was essentially totally anti-art and anti-all culture. It was the first and the greatest of the kind of we are against everything moments. If we follow the progression of one of the more famous Dadaists, Marcel Duchamp, you can see how this emerges. There is a prehistory to it. It emerges out of Cubism. So he was a Cubist painter. His famous painting, Nude Descending a Staircase from 1912, uses that idea from Braque that of multi-perspectival painting. So he's painted a nude going down a staircase, doing a separate painting of the nude every step to create this sense of movement. But he soon realized that he was tired of this kind of way of working. And one of the first big kind of things he did in 1917 was he took a toilet into an art gallery, turned it on its side, signed it with a fake name, and called it art and tried to sell it. He called it Fountain. This was kind of a big screw you to art. And he's also the guy who painted a mustache on a poster of the Mona Lisa, and again sold that as art, and then signed it with a fake name again, which is rather obscure. I don't quite understand what he's doing with that one. But just, yeah, consciously anti-art. The problem with Dada is because it was anti-everything, within 6 months it had burned out, because it's very tiring to be against everything all the time. And it's very difficult, after that first shock, to recreate that shock. People have been trying to be as shocking ever since and never quite managed it. And so Dada was struck with where to go next. And one of the big things that come out is this idea of liberation, that by destroying the old world, we're freeing people, we're creating a liberation for them, that they're going to be, that art can be part of the force to liberate us from our old ways of thinking and being. So some Dadaists, like here we've got Erwin Blumenfeld's Art in 1916, which is sort of a common, it's as much of a piece of satire as it is a piece of anti-art, where he's got an old Victorian drawing of a painter and added bombs and generals and soldiers and things like that. And it shows how they, from being anti-everything, they slowly come back to having some ideals. But this idea of liberation, which becomes the defining feature of modernism, it really splits two ways. So you wouldn't have them describing it in this way, but I think it's a good way to go back and look at it. I get that from Jeff Nuttall's thinking on things. You can either have political liberation or you can have spiritual liberation. And they both attempted both, but yeah, Dada attempted both, and lots of these movements attempted both. But we'll break it up into the two, because I think it's easier to think about that way as we go through the modernist art period at the start of the 20th century. So Futurism is the first great art movement for political liberation. It's a kind of totally mad has totally mad politics. Depending on who you ask, it was either proto-fascist or it was a joke that got out of hand. They believed in the destruction of everything. They wanted to burn everything from the past, including the art galleries and the museums. And they worshipped speed and the creation of new people that could live in the new way. So this is a sculpture from Umberto Boccioni, The Unique Forms of Continuity in Space, 1913. And you can see how they've stripped away the human form and replaced it with either kind of metallic. It's a metal sculpture for a start, so it's not attempting to replicate the human form as marble does, where it has that kind of special effect that makes it feel like human flesh when you look at it. Here the face is a piece of a steel girder with a hook attached to her nose, and the rest of it appears to be kind of the clothing of a person being moved by the spirit, by the will, with no kind of human flesh beneath it. It's almost as if it's a robot that's got human clothes on. And there's this ideal of pure movement, pure kind of aggression in modernity, which is part of their political ideal. They did strange typographical experiments. They brought out magazines in which you could barely read them, because as you can see there, all the text is kind of really messed up and mashed up. The idea behind this one was that it would be, they loved planes and aeroplanes and thought that everyone should have their own aeroplane. And so this is kind of text that resembles Italy when seen from above. There were people like, where are we? This is Luigi Rossolo, who was created his own instruments. He was a composer who got tired of the orchestra and so built his own instruments that were largely there to blast sound at you. He was the first noise composer. He thought that sound was old-fashioned. Well, music was old-fashioned and sound should be felt instead of heard. And so people used to strap themselves in and he would just blast them with noise, which is sort of a crazy idea, but this is the kind of people they were. They did equally mad things, like they wanted to abolish pasta, which, you know, for Italians is as radical as you can get. And they created a new edible art, which included things like filling a chicken with bullets and putting it in the oven because it would like make you feel alive when all the bullets were flying around everywhere. And they wanted food that could float, that was lighter than air. They had things as well like Ferdinand Lager's Ballet Mécanique, which was, he thought, the problem with ballet is it's done by people, and people are kind of old-fashioned, and we need to replace them with machines. We should have machines to do our dancing now. And so he built a whole kind of ensemble of various machines that did things that looked like they were dancing, and they were these dancing machines, the Ballet Mécanique. In terms of painting, which is perhaps some of the less bizarre of the futurist work, we have this piece, Farewells by Umberto Boccioni, who's perhaps the finest of the artists. Marinetti is the most famous of the kind of political speakers and theorists of the futurists, but Boccioni, he combines the multi-perspectival ideas that have come from Cubism with this emphasis on speed and modernity. So here he's gone to a train station and boarded a train and gone out to the countryside, and on his way he's painted the movements of the train, the movements of crowds, the smoke, the steam, the metal, the fire, the flames. And we have things like, in the back you've seen a radio tower, he's got modernist buildings there, he's got steam pouring out of chimneys. And so he's overlaid all of these scenes. It's like a paint. The problem with painting, he thought, was that it's too static. So this is a painting which he painted whilst moving. There was also a very kind of, whereas the Dadaists were totally anti-war and believed war to be the culmination of all of society's madnesses, futurism kind of doubled back on itself and had this weird attitude to war, which was that it was kind of a purification for humanity. It would by destroying all of the old world, it would give birth to this new one. Where this is a piece by Wyndham Lewis that he later in his life turned around and said was an anti-war piece, and so it's now, I think, hanging in the Imperial War Museum, or sometimes it's on the show there. I think it travels around. But at the time, he was dead into the First World War. He had a magazine called Blast that was celebrating the destructive potential of artillery and weaponry, and here he's got these people scavenging over a totally kind of inorganic world. All the trees have been burned and destroyed, and they're sort of turning into shattered buildings and steel. The people who made the steel girders, there's bombs lined up and, you know, weaponry, and they're all kind of becoming men that are like machine men that are sort of soft. Even the faces of the two who are the only human looking ones in the front have got very harsh geometric lines that make them look tough and kind of like war has kind of turned them into iron kind of creatures. And this all led on to, well, as I say, for some of these artists, it was kind of a bit of an intellectual game. But for some, they took it really seriously. And so Futurism essentially led into Italian fascism, which is slightly different than German fascism, but it's still fascism, which is, you know, never a good thing. So this is a painting by Ambrosi Mussolini, the aviator. They sort of loved Mussolini because he was an aviator, he flew planes, and he was the strong man, he was the embodiment of the mechanized sort of coming together of Italy under one man. And so you can see how all this fractured imagery, and it's seen from above, they like things being seen from above, it's connected in this aggressive steel, sort of, well, it's more like a craggy kind of rock face of Mussolini. Mussolini himself being a fairly ridiculous figure, as much as he was a totalitarian tyrant, he always liked to sort of parade around in his big boots with his chin jutting out. He was kind of silly to look at. The futurists were very much a kind of, hard right, at least in the later stages, revolutionary force. But there was, inspired by them, the constructivists in Russia, because Russia in 1917, has a communist revolution there. And for a very short period after the communist revolution and before kind of the latter days of Lenin and the start of Stalin, there was a springing out of new forms of art. The idea was that the proletarian revolution and the artistic revolution are part of the same thing. Eventually, all these people were killed in the gulags because they were seen as being anti-Russian, and they replaced it with the communist art that we're used to seeing, which is a lot of kind of smiley-faced children looking up to Comrade Stalin and people driving tractors. The constructivists were essentially futurists with a communist bent. And so rather than wanting the individual Iron Man, they wanted to create the new Soviet man, the Homo Sovieticus. And so this was designed for a new tower block to sort of celebrate the Russian Revolution that would include no brickwork or concrete at all, and would just be pure steel. I don't really know what you could do with it, because there's no room for anything on it. It's just kind of like a sculpture. But that was the kind of way they thought. Lissitzky was they got rid of all painting and said painting had to serve a direct political purpose. Because painting, as the Dadaists said, was kind of bourgeois and corrupt. And so the great kind of conceptual artists of that period and the great sort of visual painters worked in posters. So a lot of them did basic posters that told you a message, but some like Lissitzky essentially took conceptual ideas and did them in poster form. So this was, believe it or not, a recruitment poster for the army. The reason for that is that there were three forces active in Russia after the Russian Revolution. There was the Whites, who were the old forces of the Tsarist regime. There were the Blacks, who were the anarchist forces, who were kind of revolutionaries who didn't support Lenin. And there were the Red Army, who were the Bolsheviks under Lenin. And so the Red Army, who are recruiting with this poster, the Red Wedge is smashing the Whites and the Blacks here. And so you find some really interesting visual kind of stuff that goes on with these posters. I don't know if they actually did the job of a poster, but it was their idea of things. And you also get a huge amount of breakthroughs in cinema, which is really brand new at the time. There's only been about 5 years since the movie camera has been developed. And with movies like Zsigmond Vertov's Man with a Movie Camera from 1929, we essentially see from what's essentially a strange kind of Marxist idea, which is Marx had a theory that history moves on through dialectics, that you have a thesis and antithesis, and these come into contact and sort of clash and produce a synthesis. So you have capitalism, and you have the workers oppressed by capitalism, and they crash together and they make socialism. And that was his kind of idea of how history progressed. And so Zsigmond Vertov took a load of random images of things that, like bits of footage from around Russia, revolutionary Russia, and he put two scenes that didn't appear to fit together, and then the third one, which brought them together. And this was the invention of the montage technique, which is now fundamental to all movies. You watch any movie and there's a montage in it, and sometimes you don't even notice you're watching a montage. Like, someone walks into a room, we see an object, oh, they're in the room looking at the object. We just kind of understand that now. But that was developed by the constructivists as one successful technique among many, many, many unsuccessful experiments. Now, the underlying both of these sort of political philosophies was the idea that art and design could entirely remake people, that you could turn people into kind of warrior creatures, Übermenschen or Homo Sovieticus. This idea that you could, by changing people's culture, you could entirely change who they were. This idea gets picked up and shifted and depoliticized by the Bauhaus. And the Bauhaus are incredibly important because they absorb all of these strange, aggressive energies and turn them into this new apolitical thing called design. So the very idea of, you know, designing something, that sort of term comes out of the Bauhaus. The term Bauhaus means the house of construction, and it was a school that you could go to and you would be taught a comprehensive education in a whole range of things. So on Monday you'd be learning metalwork, on Tuesday you'd be learning architecture, on Wednesday you'd be learning painting and painting theory, on Thursday you'd be doing textiles, and it kind of taught you the full spectrum of design. It was set up by Walter Gropius, the German architect, who had lots of famous sayings that he used, like less is more, form follows function. And in terms of buildings, especially, he called them, borrowed from Le Corbusier, he calls them machines for living. So the architecture of the Bauhaus is hugely kind of influential. Bauhaus architecture is sort of unlike anything that's come before. It's stripping away everything that's unnecessary, and that there's no decoration, although they say that, but often I think this big fin on the top looks like it's probably for decorative purposes. But they aim to have no decoration, and they should be machines for living, that buildings should just purely be designed around the function of them and to make them as pleasant to use as possible. So here we've got big, wide windows, lots of light coming in. We've got this kind of area at the top for sunbathing, and it's lifted up so that you've got a downstairs area that you can sit outside, but the building itself forms the cover for you. A lot of it is really interesting, innovative, revolutionary design, and it challenged the idea that for something to be nice, it needed to have a decorative element. So they painted everything in white, for example. They tried to have as many windows as possible, because rather than make room for having a nice mural on the wall, just put a window, because natural light is nicer than that. We can see the kind of urge to simplification also occurring in things like in the metal workshop, where you had Marianne Brandt. Marianne Brandt was the head of the metalworking workshop, and she created a whole series of these designs which are totally revolutionary, which now are just kind of, they're part of the language of things like IKEA. You know, it's like you probably have something Bauhaus inspired in your kitchen. This, for example, was considered incredibly revolutionary, the one teacup teapot. The design came from, if you wanted one cup of tea, they took the design of a cup for a cup of tea and turned the teapot into one of exactly the same dimensions. And so you put one, you know, bit of tea in there, you put enough water in for one cup, and so you got a one teacup teapot. She designed this, which back in the day when you could smoke inside, used to be everywhere. I don't know. You'd have to have smoking. Yeah, I'd have to smoke or have smoking relatives to see them now, but they used to be everywhere. It's the pop top ashtray. So you pop the top open, you can drop your cigarette in, you can crush it on the side and it'll all go down, and then you pop it closed and it's airtight. So the problem with, you know, a cigarette dimp is that it's on fire, and it's not good to have that hanging around your house. You know, many is the people who's, you know, accidentally set themselves on fire or burned a hole in the couch because they've dropped fag ash on it. So here it was a kind of, you take the oxygen out, it puts the flame out. It's a really utilitarian design, and it has nothing that's not necessary in it. So it's that, again, a celebration of sort of metal and chrome and the simplicity of things. She was also the first designer to create a clock that doesn't have numbers. The idea being that we all know where the numbers are, so why put the numbers on? This super simplified design was picked up by the students, and they developed things like there's the Vasily chair, named after Vasily Kandinsky, who we saw in, I think, last week, and we're going to see again shortly. This is an armchair which has had all the extra elements removed. So, you know, this armchair shape and all the functional bits that you sit on are provided for you in leather, but the rest of it has been taken away. In fact, I've sat on one of these, and it's awful. It feels terrible. You think you're going to damage your spine. So it didn't actually work, but it's a nice idea. One that did work was the Mies van der Rohe chair, which, again, is stripping a chair back to its simplest, not only in terms of conceptually, but also in terms of industrially. So this is two pieces of metal and two pieces of leather. One piece of metal forms the entire outer casing, and the second one just reinforces it at the bottom, and then there's two strips of leather, and from just four pieces of material, you've created a whole chair. So it's totally a totally different design philosophy to what we saw with arts and crafts, you know, the thick, heavy wooden objects. Here it's like simplified light, as simple as possible. So the Bauhaus kind of represents the end point of that desire to shift, change people politically, to have a political liberation. It kind of leads it back to a kind of, you know, something that's possible and useful. Now, if we take a step back to the end of Dada and look at the spiritual liberation, it's useful to look at the Surrealists. So the Surrealists are kind of a response to Dada because they saw these chaotic, strange, eccentric, wild and wacky images that the Dadaists meant to be totally meaningless. And they thought, well, actually, maybe there is a hidden meaning. Because they read a lot of Freud, and Freud had a theory that things like dreams and jokes and slips of the tongue, and when you accidentally do something, but it kind of does what you want it to do, all of these things form part of a release for the hidden world of the unconscious. That our day-to-day lives, we have to shut off certain bits of our consciousness so that we can get through the day, and we repress the rest. And so the Surrealists thought, through this kind of strange assemblage of imagery, the Dadaists has accidentally released the unconscious. And so they went about painting strange images in an attempt to help people release their own unconsciousness and as the artist to release theirs. So this one is René Magritte's The Treachery of Images from 1936, which I quite like because it's quite funny. That's one of the other benefits of... Freud theorized, he wrote a whole book called The Unconscious and Jokes, where he believed that jokes are funny because they release unconscious energies. And so a lot of surrealism is quite funny as well. So here you've got a guy smoking his own nose. And here's one of the most famous ones, Dali's Persistence of Memory. So this is, Dali painted whilst sometimes under the influence of drugs, sometimes he would eat a lot of raw meat or cheese and go to bed and write down his dreams. But there's also a lot of meaning behind what he does in the sense of it's always on these deserts. A lot of the Surrealists copy the whole desert background. But in fact, that was where Dali grew up, was in a bit of Spain that looked like that. So this is kind of nostalgic. The weird sleeping figure and the ants are one of his own personal phobias. But the melting clocks is also tying back to that thing about time, the idea that there was a realization at that time that time was kind of an abstract man-made concept, that it was relative, that, you know, clocks themselves were not objective. And so here we've got clocks melting all over the place. And here's my favorite piece of surrealism, Merit Oppenheim's My Nursemaid, which is quite funny because it's, you know, it's high heels that are made up to look like a chicken about to get come out of the oven. But it also uses a lot of what Freud calls the uncanny, which is that this kind of suggestion of menace underlying the conscious world. Merit Oppenheim was big into kind of ideas of kind of womanhood and perceptions of womanhood, and she uses a lot of shoes because she sees the kind of the fashionable shoe of the 1920s as being kind of representing the female form, and it's, you know, it's a highly fetishized object. So here she ties two of them together and strings them up, and so there's a kind of sadomasochistic undertone to it, which is, you know, supposed to kind of, you're supposed to kind of know it's there but not know it's there, and not know should mention that that's what it reminds you of, or and the idea of like eating these shoes that are also a chicken that are also suggestive of a woman's body. It's kind of very disturbing image, but also initially quite funny. She's done quite a lot of funny ones. She's done one called Squirrel, which is a pint of beer, but instead of a handle it's a squirrel's tail. She helps Dali create the idea for a lobster phone, which is a telephone, but instead of a receiver it's a lobster, you know, stuff like that. In terms of where this moves, though, because whereas the Surrealists are kind of very in your face, there's then another spiritual movement in art, which is to strip everything back to its kind of furthest point. So Pierre Mondrian and De Stijl, which I think were a Belgian or possibly Dutch style, I can't quite remember, believed that all art should be stripped back to its basic elements, and that this had a kind of spiritual purgative quality to it. So in the same way that those Dutch 17th century Puritans wore all black, they would only paint with straight lines and cubes using the three primary colours. De Stijl, after doing a few famous paintings, kind of stops being influential, but it was important because it inspired Kandinsky. And Kandinsky is the first artist to move to pure abstraction. So Kandinsky we saw last week because he had a phase which was expressionist. And so here you can see in his expressionism, he does a lot of kind of quite peaceful scenes. Last week we saw one that was a country house. Here we have some boats on a river, but he uses wild and wacky textures and colors and to express his own inner passions and feelings whilst he's painting. He was a Russian working in Germany because that's where expressionism was. He went back to Russia after the revolution and became a constructivist and shifted his style to account for the constructivist stuff that we were speaking about shortly before, trying to make new art that would have the energy and liveliness of the new Soviet world whilst also being appealing to people. So he used lots of bright colours and things like rainbows, sort of childish images of people, because he thought this would appeal to the Russian people. However, he got the sense that there was something dangerous looming in the Russian Revolution, and he left. Luckily, about 6 months before, everyone that he knew in the constructivist movement was killed or sent off to the camps in Siberia. He ended up back in Germany, where he went to the Bauhaus, and in the Bauhaus, he was one of two tutors, the other one being Paul Klee, who taught the abstract forms of painting. So because the Bauhaus was to teach engineers and designers as opposed to artists, the art classes stopped being about the sorts of stuff that you guys are learning, like, you know, drawing in perspective, getting the human anatomy right, stuff that takes ages to learn and only real artists could do it. Instead, he focused on stuff that would be useful for a designer, so colour theory, theory of shape and movement, theory of kind of how you use a canvas to create compositions. And so he worked backwards and did super simplified sort of assemblages that got increasingly abstract over time. So here we have some floating cubes demonstrating color theory and also the use of perspective, like linear perspective. We've got these lines and strange shapes sort of showing the simplified shape language and a lot of kind of movement and energy in it. He then, after moving out of the Bauhaus, started to write his own books, including Concerning the Spiritual in Art and Point, Line and Plane, which are books that kind of conceptualize an art entirely separated from the existent world. And he believed that the stripping back art to its purest, like, abstract forms would release this new spiritual understanding of the world. So that he kind of argued that we've wasted all our time doing paintings of stuff. Now we should just do paintings that are paintings in and of themselves. He was doing this really early, so this is a 1923 painting. He was writing some of his books in 1919. So, you know, he was very, very early to this game, and he pretty much is the first, we call it non-figurative painter, the conceptual break, the moment when paintings stop being of something. Although arguably you can still kind of see something in them that looks kind of to be like a speedometer and wings of an airplane and things. But Kandinsky's conceptual break is the kind of, it kind of underlies a lot of movements that then return in America. As I said at the start, America's kind of, the 20th century is the American century, and American art really picks up where Kandinsky's leaves off in the wreckage of Europe. And in America, we have this new form of art called abstract expressionism, featuring painters like Pollock, where the entire point is not to paint something, but to celebrate just paint itself. The canvas itself as texture, as sort of colour, as living kind of energy. And also the painters fostered their own kind of celebrity appeal. So Pollock as a figure was kind of a celebrity who'd do performances as he did his painting, and that was half of the fun of it. And also it was to do with commodification. So the abstract expressionists were the first painters who made massive, massive amounts of money because America, especially American millionaires, were so rich and they needed new commodities to buy. The paintings like this that kind of didn't require any previous knowledge as to, you know, the history of religion or culture, but you could just look at them and like them or not like them. They had an exclusivity kind of benefit, because if you bought one and were like, yes, look at my beautiful art, and someone didn't understand it, you could go, well, I paid $15 million for it. You go, oh, well, it must be good because it's $15 million. So I must be dumb because I don't understand it. And there was that sort of tension with it. Abstract expressionism is trying to, yeah, remove the idea of depicting things from art. And then we return to Rothko, who's a Seagram mural, section 6, 1959. Rothko believed that you could use micro tones of colour shift to sort of wake up people's spiritual sense. He picks up where Kandinsky leaves off and removes the idea of shape and composition and just leaves colour and attempts to make these huge paintings where the colour will kind of have effects upon you. I've seen that once with Rothko. I was in a gallery and there was no one else there, and there was this giant sort of Rothko in front and two to the side, and you can sit there and get surrounded by these vast paintings, and you realize that even though they look all black and red, there's all these microtones of red and black, and you spend a while looking at them and suddenly you get this weird feeling because it's sort of in half light and stuff. I think that's how you have to view them. So there is something in them, but a lot of the time they just look like squares of paint. And I think a lot of people who copied Rothko maybe didn't know that that's what he was doing, and so they just painted squares and got famous off it. So sometimes a square of paint is just a square of paint. Now, that pretty much is the end point of modernism. And then we get this moment where all of this kind of conflictual, hyper-serious theorizing about art shifts and moves into something slightly more fun. And we know that as postmodernism. And postmodernism is kind of art about art. So as much as abstract expressionism is painting about painting, we have in architecture the shift to postmodernism, where it came first was in things like brutalism. So a 1960s style, which takes that nice, clean Bauhaus line, which at that point had become so popular that you had tons of those. Every terrible 1960s, you know, awful block of flats. You can look out the window and see a couple of surviving ones out there. There's just, you know, a series of depressing looking windows in a big cube. Brutalism was kind of a response against this. It was to celebrate the rawness and brutality of concrete, kind of buildings that intentionally looked aggressive, that looked kind of like they would weigh a ton, they were kind of menacing things. If you're into your concept art, brutalism is really good to get into, because if you ever want to, you know, design a fortress or like somewhere where they're supposed to be menacing, then brutalism is always really good for that sort of thing. It is also sort of self-reflective in that it's celebrating the materials that the building is made of. They had a kind of fetishistic relationship with metal and with particularly concrete, like massive blocks of concrete that serve no purpose. That's the big thing with brutalism. Brutalism is a 60s style. Cut forward to the 80s and the 90s, and then you have this high postmodernism, buildings made for fun. So this one is Kengo Kuma's M2 building from 1991. To tie back to my idea that you can tell a lot about a culture from how it uses pillars, here's an ironic pillar that's kind of placed in the middle of this building that itself looks a bit like a spaceship or like a boat or something. It's like a mast that is an ionic pillar that's there kind of, it's just there for fun, which is something that you wouldn't get in the very serious modernist period. In the postmodernist period, stuff is done because it's fun, it's wacky, it takes loads of different elements and sticks them together. In the same way that, I guess, arts and crafts, they took lots of bits and stuck them together, but in arts and crafts you were obliged to make it look good and make it look like it worked. In postmodernism, as long as it sort of works vaguely on a certain level, you can get away with it being bad taste, with it being kitsch, with it being like fun but a bit tacky. That's a lot of the kind of energy of it. And then you've got modern architecture. This is an Ian Simpson, a Manchester lad. This is his one Blackfriars from 2018. Ian Simpson is responsible for the whole glass and steel thing, particularly in Manchester. And here we have architecture that is attempting to dissipate, to disappear. Marx had a saying about that. Well, he thought about capitalism, but you could apply it to any modern society, that the more technology advances, everything, all that is solid melts into air. That's what he says. All that is solid melts into air. And with a lot of these buildings, I feel like that is what's happening, because all of the structure is on the outside. Everything inside is on these little plates, and those sit on the structure, which is external. You can see it in the building being built next door, in fact. They put up those steel girders first, and then they lay what we stand on those girders. And so the whole structure is external, and yet that structure, to the naked eye, is just glass. And so the structure isn't there. It's like a building that's not a building, a building that's aspiring to just be air. And when you listen to modern architects speak, they don't speak about buildings and about design and about decoration, or they talk about space. So the modern architect's approach is to think about spaces and places, and they talk in these very abstract terms, with any form of structure stripped away and sort of dissipated. In terms of art, we have this sort of movement of postmodernism through pop art. People like Andy Warhol, who did had art that was fun, art that was disposable, that you were supposed to look at, get a bit of a giggle out of, and then get rid of. he did his, you know, famous paint cans. So instead of doing a still life of fruit, he did like paint cans, soup cans. Here he took Marilyn Monroe, a famous movie star, and reproduced her face loads of times as a kind of comment on the reproducibility of faces, and then added fun colors. You have things like op art. Op art was another 60s art movement that was intended to create effects that really sort of freak you out and bend perception. There was a fantastic op art retrospective in Liverpool a couple of years ago, and you genuinely felt dead sick going through it. It was like going to a kind of hall of mirrors. So if you stare long enough at that middle point, it sort of sucks in your eye, and you kind of got this weird psychedelic effect. You know, this is a time when a lot of drugs were being taken, so the fact that a painting could give you a kind of druggy buzz, it's very different from the function of paintings traditionally. It's painting for fun, painting that has a kind of popular effect. You then get, towards the late 60s, the creation of happenings. And happenings are the birth of, I guess, art that's only art because we don't know what else to call it. The happening, which then gives birth to the kind of performance art and that whole structure, it was created by Ken Kesey, who wrote the book One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. After the book came out, the movie of the book, he became a millionaire, didn't know what to do with it, and he didn't think that books were worth writing anymore. And so he got a bus called Further and painted it in psychedelic colours. He got the band The Grateful Dead to go on tour with him, and acid, like LSD, which was a new thing, they took around, and they basically created, through just basically taking drugs in every town that they could across America, this new idea of freedom movement, and they developed light shows and projections and the very first, like, stuff that you get now with any rock show. You know, you go to an Ariana Grande concert and they play flashing lights and loud music and they've got a screen where there's visualizations. All that comes from this, the Kool-Aid acid tests, where it was the first time that they did all that, using strobes, using things to give psychedelic effects. Part of this was that idea of liberation again. It was freeing people from their everyday life, giving them something fun, and a new sideways look at life. So this developed into happenings like, for example, Jerry Rubin and Abbie Hoffman tried to elect Pigasus J. Pig to the US presidency, and ended up falling out with each other because they couldn't decide that after Pigasus got elected president, are they going to eat him or not? One of them arguing that they were vegetarians, so they shouldn't eat the president. The other one saying it would be the first useful thing an American president has ever done for his people. There was Jeff Nuttall in England, who made an obstacle course inside of a bus and drove it around. So if you were getting on the bus to work, you would have to do a bit of an obstacle course on your way. It's a way to kind of introduce a bit of fun to everyday life. Yoko Ono, most famous for breaking up the Beatles, began as one of these happening artists. So she did a piece called... I can't remember what it's called, actually. I've not written it down. From 1961, anyway, where she put a bunch of fabric on the floor near the entrance, and as people walked in and stepped on it, they then came in and there was nothing on the walls. And they're like, where's the art? And she picked up the doormat and hung it on the wall and was like, there's the art, ha-ha. which isn't the best art, but she did do a better one called Cut Piece in 1964, where she basically sat there and gave people a pair of scissors and told them they could do what they want. And so from a start where everyone's a bit like, well, I don't want to do anything, it ended up with people sort of cutting her clothes off, cutting her hair off, and it got really aggressive and kind of, it had to be called off. But it was this, Marina Abramovich has done a similar thing recently, although, you know, when Yoko Ono did it, it was original and less aggressive than her one. But interesting, makes you think. That became this new kind of thing was to kind of upset your expectations, to make you think, to take you out of your everyday life. That was the whole function of it. So I've got a bit of a clip here from Jeff Nuttall, who's, he was my mate Steve's teacher when he was in his 70s, because he was a hugely famous artist in the 60s who then, at the height of his fame, ran away to Todmorden down the road and became an art teacher. This is his time teaching at the Leeds Polytechnic, if I can find it.
Thank you. can tell it's the 70s with those haircuts.
I must say, Jeff, as an intellectual philistine, that nothing that I have seen this morning seems to me to bear any relation at all to art, to learning, or indeed to sanity.
It doesn't really bear much relation to learning or sanity, except insofar as one finds out new things by doing new things. Most of the things that we're doing here haven't been done before, except until very recently, and therefore one's exploring new area, and therefore it's to do with learning. But it's nothing to do with established disciplines of learning, certainly not. It's expanding learning rather than operating within given traditions. And as for sanity, well, I hope it's insane. You know, I would hope so. I am, and I really have a certain amount of faith in sanity, and no faith at all in sanity.
I think you're going to worry and possibly upset.
There we go. I think you meant to say no faith at all in insanity and faith in insanity. Either way, there's Jeff Nuttall. He's a fun guy. Oh no, we've gone all the way back to the start. I guess. Hold on to your seats. A lot of art hitting you simultaneously. So there he is. So yeah, that kind of 60s, 70s, anti-commercial art that gets in your face, art that's kind of there to liberate and to free the mind, kind of meets its culmination in the 1990s, where it meets with the commercialization that we saw with abstract expressionism. So whereas abstract expressionism is these paintings that are just made up of like lots of paint flung at a wall, and then they became commodified, the young British artists of the 90s, this is Tracy Emin's My Bed from 1998, took this kind of, I guess, guerrilla art, conceptual art, happenings kind of idea, and turned it into a way to make massive amounts of money. And so My Bed, which was just her bed after, a weekend-long binge, I think it is, because you can see all the booze and the fags and the discarded condoms and things lying around. She surrounded it with, like Jeff Nuttall did there, a kind of quasi-intellectual speech where you can go, well, it's a comment about women's lives, it's a comment about voyeurism, it's a comment about this. But the most important thing is to make sure that you write up an ironclad contract so that very rich people like Saatchi, who owns the Saatchi Gallery, can get the exclusive rights to it for millions of pounds. And then when it hits the front pages and becomes infamous and everyone hates it, that makes it more famous, makes it more valuable. And I think that kind of coming together of a kind of slightly creative but largely kind of, I don't know, uninspired, at least by this point, approach to conceptual art with heavy commodification sort of reaches its peaks with Damien Hirst's For the Love of God in 2007, which is a skull encrusted with I think it's £6 or 7 million worth of diamonds. So on its face, it's a kind of a trite comment about money and, you know, death. Like, no matter how rich you are, everyone's going to die. It's a memento mori, looking at a real human skull that's covered in these diamonds. It's also a bit blingy, a bit tacky. It's very, very shiny. There's kind of no... He didn't do it himself, which is another thing that you find these artists doing, is kind of employing people who have the skills to do the art for them. And it's also a callback to those Baroque saints who had the jewels encrusted in their heads, if you remember those. So it's got lots of different layers of meaning going on. But he knew already, because he was already a famous artist, that that investment of so much money in the materials and the labour will come back 10 times to him. So part of the artwork is the value of the artwork itself, that you're looking at something so expensive that you kind of hate it because it's so trashy, and yet it's so expensive. And I think that's kind of the peak of the young British artists. This is one of the few bits that they did that I quite like. Which leads us to our friend the banana, Maurizio Cattelan's Comedian 2018, which I think is sort of the end point of art as a commodity. Because, do you remember how much it sold for? I think it was 13 million, something like that? Somewhere between there. You buy the exclusive rights to the banana on the wall. Personally, I was a bigger, I preferred David de Tuna's
concept art performance piece called Hungry Artist, where he walked up to the banana, took it off the wall and ate it. I thought that was slightly more radical and countercultural than the banana on a wall. But at the same time, you can't stay mad at the banana on the wall. It's just a banana taped to the wall. And then a less successful piece, ultimately, by Salvatore Gurau from called I Am from 2020. This is really the end point of the trajectory of commercialization of art, where he managed to sell nothing, not for a huge amount, but for £300,000, and I'm sure, you know, if we could sell nothing for £300,000, we'd be quite happy for that. I'm sure he was hoping for the millions that the banana guy got. But when asked about it, he, in his kind of long, complicated spiel about his excuse for selling nothing, he argued that it was a pillar of air. And so this concludes our history of art with another pillar, another column. We've gone through from the ancient Egyptians, who created columns as a kind of path that marked things out as a celebration of pure geometry, to the columns that held up the ancient Grecian and Roman temples, the Baroque columns that were there to sort of beautify the world, the columns that were there as celebrations of people like Napoleon to celebrate the ego. We have the postmodern columns of 1980s architecture, and now we have a column of nothing. So I think that sort of brings us to a slightly depressing conclusion, but there's at least a trajectory to it.